Good evening, everybody. I'm Gilda Brigger. I'm French. I have short brown hair. I'm 38. I'm wearing a black shirt and grey glasses. First of all, we're going to listen to Daniel Defort, who is a doctoral student at the Reims Doctoral School with Martin Heavens as his supervisor. He's going to talk about visual cells, penitentiary cells for incarcerated blind people. Where is the biggest fault? And I hand over to him now. Good evening, I'm Daniel Defort. I've very short hair, almost a shaved head. I'm 50 and I'm wearing a red shirt and I live in Aix-en-Provence. I've chosen to talk to you about visually deficient people in prison. How do you choose to be a delinquent is the first question. We form our personality through our family environment that gives us values, and our social environment acts on our behaviour. Consequently, we see that people who've had an inverted commas normal education very rarely become delinquents. These people meet people. People who become doing have had delinquent friends, which leads us to show, to see that a human being changes over their lifetime and they can be a very good person, and at a given point in time, they suddenly become delinquent. And so we also need to ask the question, why? What makes us become delinquent? Do we choose to be a delinquent? Is there something else that makes us fall into delinquency? May either spontaneously, somebody gets angry, they don't feel good, and they act out. Or do they become professional delinquents repeatedly, and that is a bit more of a problem? Do we choose to become blind? Again, when an embryo is formed, there's a human being with all of its senses, but sometimes there are accidents along the way that cause an anomaly. So although we are born with all our senses, the trials of life mean that sometimes we can find ourselves with disabilities, physical disabilities and sensory disabilities. So, for example, to become non-sighted. Whether we're delinquents, disabled or both, they're things we don't choose. A disability and blindness adds in an additional problem, which is vulnerability, because vulnerability makes us fragile every day, and even more so when we're in prison. There's a paradox in which an incarcerated person is seen as a dependent, fragile, vulnerable person, but and we think they can't be dangerous, whereas no handicap stops us from breaking the law and being punished as people who have no deficiencies. And so the prisons need to be able to accommodate disabled people. There's a law from 2005 that says that public access prisons need to be accessible to disabled people, and prisons are not an exception to that rule. And they shouldn't constitute an additional sentence for disabled people, which should take into account their needs and meet those needs. All vulnerable people today that are blind, clinically blind, either totally or partially, where they if they are deprived of their liberty and are in prison, they are alone in a cell. They don't know where they are. And so what happens is that these people don't have any landmarks. Either they're alone or with cellmates. And at a certain point in time, for example, when they need to perform their toilet, they can't move, they can't go to the shower, they don't know how to move around because they have nothing, no tactile landmarks to tell them where they are. So what happens is that these vulnerable people are subject to or become subject to their cellmates who aren't always very pleasant, and it is the cellmates or the prison guards who take the place of carers to help them to wash themselves or confront the universe around them. And for me, this is something that isn't normal because these people are already in a vulnerable condition. They're in prison. These are two things that for human beings are dramatic. They're deprived of their fundamental rights because they're not recognized. And as they're vulnerable, what happens, as in all groups, is that there are people with strong personalities who go towards these people to say, I'll help you, don't worry. But the person, the vulnerable person, becomes indebted. And so they're deprived of everything. They start trusting the people that are guiding them. But then, at a certain point in time, these people or other people will influence, that's not the right word really, but they'll exploit the disability to make them do things that they shouldn't do, that they don't want to do, but because they're disabled and vulnerable, they'll start putting themselves in very difficult situations. And the problem with accessibility prisons is that we should have prisons that are adapted to all forms of disability. But for now, the law exists. This came out a few years ago. But due to prison overcrowding and the work that would need to be done, as things stand at the time being, with the problems of accessibility for people in wheelchairs and visually impaired people, they can't, for example, go out into the exercise yard, which means they're cut off from society, from the prison society. They can't make friends. And then the penitentiary law obliges to take these people and put them in other prisons. And then what happens is that they're isolated even more because they're taken further away from their families and they no longer have any landmarks at all. They're already destabilized due to the change of prison. And in addition, they can no longer talk to their families or see their families. It's the same thing for going to the visiting room. There are people who are visually impaired who don't have any landmarks. They need to be taken to where they're going to be able to go and see their families. Education. There too, there's almost no books in Braille. There are no resources so that they can read for themselves. I think that disability is already a factor of exclusion in the outside world, but this isolation is accentuated in prison. This exclusion is seen on two levels. Firstly, by isolation from their families, and it's already, it's also prejudiceable to reinsertion, because people aren't incarcerated for life. They're going to come out one day, and the aim is that they shouldn't come back. That is the subject of my thesis, to understand why people who are come back into society sooner or later go back to prison. So these are the difficulties encountered by the people who are incarcerated. So I think I've said most of what I wanted to say. Thank you very much, Gilles. And now we're going to listen to Aishi, who's a professor in sociology and a member of the Institute in Strasbourg.
I'm not sure if you can see me. But thank you for giving me the floor. And I have apparently 5 minutes, and I'm afraid I'm not able to be here for the whole of this session. But I'd briefly like to tell you about what I've been talking with Frédéric Reichert over the last few years. We've been working on a comparative approach to disability within France. France, Belgium, Switzerland, and sub-Saharan African countries, looking at two types of disability, and in particular for those living in our region of Africa. The text we passed on emphasized in particular albinism, and I wanted to explain why we wanted to talk about these types of disability, because firstly, in the general population, the rate is 1 per 50,000, but in Africa, it's more like 1 in 1,000. This is also the case of river blindness in intertropical areas. 90% of sufferers are in sub-Saharan Africa. And these two disabilities affect skin conditions and also sight. And these issues cover several areas, including that of social representation and how people are treated in society. This view is not only anthropological, but historico-anthropological. And when you look at these two pathologies, there is serious discrimination against these categories of individual, and there are some examples of individuals with river blindness who have been able to move on in life. And they will be liable to be treated as heroes. And on the other hand, people affected with albinism may be the victims of cultural or ritual violence. This is particularly the case in sub-Saharan Africa. This may be at birth. Others may see albinos may play a particular role in the ritual, the cultural process to do with ancestors, a visible, so this person may become sought out because they're believed to hold powers with regard to ancestors. Sometimes these people are killed to harvest their organs or bones, because these are believed to confer powers. And All of this, of course, takes place in a particular social and cultural environment. As a triple heritage, the African ancestral heritage, then changes with colonialization, and then westernization, which will mean, on the one hand, these people will be cared for, or there'll be some attempt to take them into account, as you've heard previously, with the social involvement and social participation of those individuals. Thank you very much. We are going to try and see if Nidal Mahmoud is with us. He is a doctor of literature, researcher at an Institute of French Language and Literature, written on Lucien Descaves, published in 2020, called Lucien Descaves, and as a reflection of his works, from naturalist roots to libertarian ideas. And there's the personality of the blind person in religious literature. Hope that he will be able to join us soon. I'm just going to give you a brief summary of his paper in the meantime. This is very different from the two previous presentations because Nidal Mahmoud's text presents a much more positive image of blind people while being somewhat abnormal because the blind person sees what cannot. In his Tal Ben Jerun's work, known as The Sacred Night, Nidal Mahmoud studies the character of a blind person, a central person in the story called the consul, who is a blind man who teaches the Quran, and his sister, who served him, calls him the consul because she imagined him in a diplomatic career. But in actual fact, this consul allows the heroine of the book, Zahra, to become a woman in her own right because the father had wanted to behave as a boy because he already had 8 daughters and did not want a 9th and wanted to restore his honour amongst other young men of the town. And so he ordered his daughter Zahra to become a boy, and the consul, who is blind, enables Zahra to become a woman, and he is extremely sensitive, and he encourages Zahra to face her fears and emancipate herself through spirituality, through mysticism, Sufism. And Zahra and the consul will also experience a romantic relationship which emancipates her, and having killed her uncle in a fit of violence, is able to survive prison as a result of this. So Tal Ben Jerun describes a blind person who is a great poet, highly sensitive, who sees what others do not see. And in this work, blindness allows the consul to achieve harmony with the world and with himself, and enables the heroine Zahra to also come to terms with her, who she is. Nidal Mahmoud is now with us. So I briefly summarized your paper. So over to you. Thank you. Thank you very much for this excellent summary. And before talking about that, a brief word of introduction. And please do switch on your camera if you wish. I'm afraid I'm not able to at the moment. Anyway. I won't describe myself physically either. That way you can leave your imagination to run riot, because I believe that voices are already a way of creating a mental image of the owner of the voice. So it's up to you who are listening to me to, from my tone of voice, to construct a visual image of who I am. I'm a research partner with a research institute attached to Paris Sorbonne. I work on naturalist and realistic literature in the 19th century and an anarchist literature from the 1890s, and I also interested in disability studies, and particularly the role of the blind person within French literature and North African French-speaking literature, including the literature of Tara Benjeloun. And I'm delighted to be able to tell you about our research and to do so with specialists, Marion Chotin, Céline Roussel. I have a very, and Hannah Thompson. Within disability studies, and my work goes back to 2011 when I started to look at Lucien Decave, who was the subject of my PhD. Somebody I ran across somewhat by chance in the Valentin Aouy library in Paris. I saw a hand transcribed book in Braille called The Walled In People, dedicated to the blind and the sighted, to free the former and raise the awareness of the latter. And I believe that was fully the issue of the time. The novel is a time, a product of its time, the naturalist period. Cav, however, gets away from the stereotypical characters of his day and the stereotypes of the authors of his day, and his protagonist is a blind man called Sévigné, and describes his biography, his struggle against a world that is not always in favour of the emancipation of the blind. This novel is part literature, part sociology, part literature. And I devoted my contribution at a conference in November 2015 in Paris to this subject. The proceedings of the symposium were published in 2019, and I in particular mentioned aspects of this novel with regard to intersensory perception, which are really central to the aesthetics of Lucien Decave. So after the Walled In, this novel, I then looked for other characters in French literature and this led me to a number of authors and characters. I'm currently conducting comparative study of a number of authors, including Lucien Decave, from a comparative perspective, looking at the blind person in Eastern literature. This led me back to Tara Benjeloun, very well-known, prolific writer studied by many critics, and having read his novel The Sacred Night, published in 1987, I looked at how his unusual treatment of the issue, as you summarized it just now. In my research, and in fact in almost all my work, I've adopted a thematic approach, Jean-Pierre Richard being one of the architects of this approach, where he defines the theme as a practical organizational principle, an object, for example, round which an entire world is constructed. Themes are constructed in terms of recurrence, and the recurring themes in a work will give us a way of interpreting the work as a whole. So post-colonial North Africa is an environment in which we can look at theoretical considerations of blindness from religious and social perspectives, sociological perspectives. I also deemed it relevant to look at the views of Islam on the blind and physical disabilities in general. And in my paper on this issue in Arabic and Muslim societies, it's often
moyen tout à fait efficace pour interagir avec leur semble.
Highlighting the fact that prior to the 2000s, the blind was not possible previously. Now this has become more possible in the Arab and Muslim world. There are some famous blind individuals who have made their impact on this world. Abhal al-Nahaji, who is a poet who has had an effect on medieval Arab literature, and was another who was education minister in Egypt in the 1950s, and was shortlisted for the Nobel Literature Prize. So this novel is based around a fundamental paradox: the fact that the blind man sees more than the others. Mysticism apparent in this novel through the predominant Sufism in the work is a way of rehabilitating this figure of the blind man. So there's a metaphysical role, metaphysics plays a role in rehabilitating the blind man, bringing his contemporaries out of the blindness of materialism. This process is at the crossroads of philosophy and metaphysics. So, on the one hand, highly rationalistic and extremely fantastic metaphysics, and the something of a glorification of blindness.
Thank you very much for your presentation. The text presents a much more positive image of the blind person, whereas the works of Celestin Lamour encourage greater discrimination and broken laws that blind people suffer in prison, and that albino people suffer in sub-Saharan Africa. And what struck me reading the different contributions is the question of the historic inertia of the negative representations of blindness. And in my mind, this raises a fundamental question, which is the question of the impact of public policies and historical changes in the reproduction or slight modification of these representations, because in Arab countries, there's the primacy of the oral tradition, where blind people can have high positions in society, thanks to in the Quranic instruction. But it's true that this raises the question of the complexity, that all blind children in a Muslim society won't have access to education, and so there's a complexity, a diversity of life experiences, and even a majority representation like we see in the Western world. And I think that these three texts led to questions about these dominant representations that can be that are negative, or the minority positive representations, like in Kaba Bajun's text. And so I'd like to come back to a few minutes to Daniel Dufort's text and Ajay's text. In Daniel, in your talk, you showed that blind people in prison encountered a lot of difficulties to get out of their cell because the prison isn't accessible. There's no a tactile strip, for example, and so blind people can't have access autonomously to activities, and they can't have access to certain leisure activities such as reading Braille, for example. And so all of these elements restrict the social progress of incarcerated people, and their degree of dependence is accentuated due to the unsuitability of a prison environment. And so you showed that this visual feeling is very important, given that their vulnerability sometimes causes them to be targets of other prisoners and other inmates. And I thought that was interesting. And Ajay, you also look at the representation of victims of albinism in sub-Saharan Africa, and most of these people that are victims of discrimination, their discriminations based on the fact that they're attributed magical powers, and they can be marked, they can be rejected by their families, and they're discriminated because of their lack of intelligence, or so it's thought. And they can also be victims of infanticide, and in certain territories there are hunts organised by other able-bodied men who are seeking them for their organs. And so, and they sometimes kill them even, because their organs are considered to be useful to be eaten, because they can create a link with animism. But often the reality is more complex. There's not just these representations, dominant representations that are very negative and discriminating in some societies. Albinism, somebody with albinism, can seem to be positive. For example, in Cameroon, where it seems to be a lucky mascot in the family because of their mystical powers. And so I find it was interesting to see that all of these texts talk about representations of blind people in given societies in a historical, a social, a political context, sometimes in an institution such as in prison. And so I now invite you to, or the three speakers, to answer the three key questions for the conference. Where do you situate your work in French-speaking work on disability studies? Who would like to speak first? Yes. If I would, if I could speak first, because I'll have to leave sooner. Yes, of course. Before answering this question about where my solicitors would listen to, just listen to this, I have to speak in front of the computer because the mic isn't working very well. The first element that I'd like to add, because I listened to what the previous speaker said about the overvaluation of blindness in the literature, and that in certain contexts there's the process of making heroes of blind people, and there's all the dimension of because in Africa the context is different, and you find gorillas that are values placed on because of their talent in, and then the speaker presented this very well. It's a kind of anthropology where you try to overvalue people, and this is also the role of people who are visually impaired to be able to see invisible things, to perceive things that other people can't perceive. And you, as you said very well, there's the issue of negative perceptions of images, and this is very, for example, the way people look at people and relationships with people become very reductive, and people try to domesticate otherness, and because you can't do this, people are a bit different, are rejected. And to answer you to your question about where my studies are situated, the work that I'm doing with my colleague, as I said at the beginning, this is a comparative dimension to see how in the different societies. Something that seems to be important to me is the factor of modelling. Because if you take African societies, they've been westernised with a very strong notion of the place of codification, which is found, for example, in Western biomedicine. But people do also go to seek the solutions from their ancestors. And so this dual system, which we find in Africa, we find in other places too. For example, every time we say, why do people go to Lourdes in France when they can get medical treatment? I live in Alsace, I've lived there for many years. Why do you go to an emblematic shrine that we have locally? And so we have this element of seeing where we get hold of these issues, and where we can look at the different forms of that we find of social treatment and accessibility, which my colleagues talked about that work on prisons. And now I have to leave you. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. It's true that I've been looking at disabilities for a long time because my first job was to work as a nurse. And so I was confronted with disabilities, and I still find that in my family. I've got disabled people in my family. So my research work for my thesis is looking at things that have been caused by crime. The people are repeat offenders because they find themselves in cells with other inmates who have a strong character, who try to dominate these vulnerable people. And for me, vulnerability is a certain form of disability, and it's a psychological disability. So I'm working on psychiatric conditions. For example, if you have a weak person who's mentally, you can't put them with other cellmates on the same level. That they realize that what they've done that can be corrected, and when they leave prison, they can start to live a new life. Whereas strong persons, they say, you can do this, you can do that, you can steal that, or you can sell drugs, I'll give you money. And what happens is that these strong personalities, they don't have families, and they live on the streets, and they start to become delinquents again and go back to prison. So that's my work on disabilities. Thank you, Mahmoud. Can you hear me? Yes. So, as far as I'm concerned, to answer your question, for disability studies, the French language literature from North Africa, some work that needs to be done. Because for the time being, disabled people haven't been taken into account in the socio-cultural context of North Africa, at least in literature. Most of the time, they're people in the background. They appear in certain novels, certain plays, and then they disappear without leaving any trace of themselves. And I spoke about this earlier. In most of the critical studies, the character is a disabled character doesn't have the attention that they would deserve. Often they have missed qualities which isn't related to their blindness. There could be a person incarnating a certain metaphysical vision of the world which hasn't always been explained or associated with the blindness of the character, as though it were somehow a physical defect that you'd like not to talk about. And this is contrary to the author's intentions, who would like to make the character in the disabled character into a hero, to use a substantial notion, a sort of canonization of the disabled person, because they're elevated to the rank of a saint, and a tribute is paid to them, and it's as though they're going to be able to light up our paths. In the context of North African literature, physical deficient characters don't have enough interest paid to them. And my contribution, my research, it tries to contribute to reducing or to remedying this deficiency. Thank you very much for these answers. And now I'm going to ask you the second question. How would you describe blindness studies, and what topics appear to be essential to be included in blindness studies? Blindness studies, from what I've appreciated, is the relationship with putting a person on the stage, their relationship with the world and with others, etc. The topics, the most interesting topics, seem to me to be the image that the author gives to the character, because earlier you talked about negative representations, what we can call age-old prejudices, and a lot of writers tend to give a very negative image of blindness. So when I read a literary work where there's a blind person, or another disabled person, the first thing that I'm interested in is to see what representation the author gives to this character. And then there's the way in which this character interacts with others. And that's really important. As far as Angelo is concerned, he adopted two approaches, complementary approaches, and he started with a positive approach, like Lucien Duclair. He talks about the extreme acuity of his senses, the way he deals with his daily life, and his extreme sensitivity, his intelligence, etc. And this is a rational perspective. And then he talks about metaphysics, and here he gives his character is a certain number of gifts that are inaccessible to ordinary people. And so this is vision with their heart, which is a fundamental notion in Sufism mysticism, which is a controversial stream of Islam that is very spiritualistic, that gives capital importance to the spirit and the heart. So, Mr. Difort, would you like to say anything about this? Yes? How to characterize blindness? This is not a negative vision. I see blindness. It's negative because I think there's a thing of things that we can't have. I'd say I've already said that for me, blindness studies can be taken from the aspect where I try to do as much as possible to give people sight. You can have glasses, so partially sighted people could have good glasses. For me, it's on that level, on blindness studies, to look at, researchers could look at how we can find a way to replace our eyes so that these people can see and try to discover the world. Of course, my colleague has spoke well, because with his voice, you can imagine what he looks like. Maybe that's not what he actually does look like, but at the same time, we can put ourselves in the place of partially sighted people, and when they listen to people, they can get a picture of us. But is this picture, does it really reflect what we really look like? And I put myself in their place and I say that this is always taken negatively. It is a shame not to be able to see their children, their grandchildren. But for me, studies are to look at the psychological side of seeing, to see what's happening in their lives. Where 20 years ago they could see well, and then they lose their sight, and how are they looked after? And for the people I've seen, what can we do to give them a certain form of wellness? For me, that's what it is.
Thank you. I'll just like something to add, if I may, before the last question. As to seeing things beyond materiality, I think this is one of the possible answers to today's questions, because of the search for spirituality, which is to be found in Western societies, a different way of looking at things, of looking at the world. And I think that we could definitely see this as a response to the crisis in values which the world is experiencing. And many readers of The Sacred Night had saw this as a revolutionary work from this perspective. So the last question, How's your research? What kind of definition of blindness has your research led you to adopt? So, if I may, I'll lead off. Two aspects to my response. Firstly, blindness is a deficiency with the rise of technology. This deficiency can be effectively countered, mitigated. Sometimes the gap between the sighted and non-sighted can be reduced, but nevertheless, it remains a deficiency. The second aspect of my answer is that visual deficiency can be an opportunity for a fresh exploration of the world from a new perspective, getting over and beyond a purely physical view of the world. Daniel Defoe. I would add that it leads to dependency, virtually total dependency, which can lead to psychological trauma. While my colleague sees lots of positive aspects in blindness, I cannot get over my view of it as literally handicapping. And I think if I would become blind, it would be a personal disaster. Of course, some non-sighted people don't at all want any help. But I personally cannot get away from my negative view of this. And I think, well, there's a whole breadth of views on what a good life is involved. And many different life narratives might inform our answer to that. We have our own fears. And I think, for my part, it's quite hard what is a good or bad life for myself or others. Corinne Doria, perhaps you would like to address the questions that are being raised by members of the audience. Thank you very much. Thank you to our speakers for their presentations. And this new aspect of the panel discussion, which will no doubt further enlighten us. I see there are two hands up already. You can either raise a virtual hand on Zoom or switch on your camera and wave physically, or indeed you can use the Google Doc to ask a question. Marion has a question. Thank you very much, Corinne, and thanks to our speakers. I have a question for Nidal, but first and foremost, I wanted to point out that I hope that this symposium on blindness studies has showed that there is more than one way of addressing blindness over and above ophthalmology and medical science and seeing it in terms of deficiency. And I hope that all the blind contributors to this symposium would be able to provide other perspectives than drawing a straight line between blindness and virtually total dependency and the psychological trauma that could entail, which I think that we have other things to say rather than simply assimilating blindness to a catastrophe. Nidal, I would like to say that I haven't read Taha Ben-Jerun's novel, but reading the paper which you put in and excerpts from the novel, I got the feeling that this text distilled every age-old prejudice there is in blindness. As Lucien Descaves said, had anything but a benevolent image of the blind person or a positive image or concept, because of course, while the council has a satisfactory social role as a teacher, I really saw in them the distillation of all these prejudices. He has a sixth sense, can visualize in the way that others have described. He also had this ability to be extremely insightful, see through appearances, to see the true, that have true sight, which also recalls Jacques Lucéron's talk of recruiting resistance fighters, blind people's resistance fighters, and so on. There's this an over-heroization of the blind person as a blind person who has overcome their blindness. Doesn't really do much to combat blindness. Do you not think that actually this is an opposite text to the World Inn of Descaves?
D'avoir souligné, effectivement.
You're absolutely right to highlight the fact that in this novel by Ben Jelloul, there is an exaggeration, and you're absolutely right in that respect, an exaggeration which doesn't actually help his cause. And the person to whom I submitted this article said the same thing, that very implicitly, and that's perhaps what you led to put this question to me, implicitly, I don't actually like this exaggerated treatment of the blind person who is somebody who's very clear-sighted, in fact, discerns that Zara blushes and so on. This exaggeration of positive prejudices, which is absolutely opposite to what Descaves says about blindness, may actually not be helpful to the cause of rehabilitation of blind people, by because it reinforces ideas that some may term puerile, the blind, all the all-seeing blind person, and a positivist could just see this as a catalogue of prejudices, and but you could indeed come to that conclusion reading this novel, and perhaps Tara Ben-Jelloul could, we feel, have toned things down a bit. But that said, his image of the blind person is nonetheless positive. Thank you. Yes, I believe, perhaps, but I think that there are positive prejudices which have extremely harmful effects, equally harmful as negative prejudices. Of course, I am not the only person with that view. Yes, which is why you are right to raise the point. As the proverb says, the best is the enemy of better. Exaggeration may actually end up having a blowback effect, a rebound effect, which is not good. And that is indeed a valid criticism of Ben Jelloul, with this exaggeration, putting their character on a pedestal, and as a result, perhaps not done himself any favours. Especially with respect to this metaphysical considerations that don't have much to do with real life. And in real life, somebody may meet a non-sighted person and attribute to them the attributes that they have encountered in this fictional character. But we will hope that perhaps they do not make such a leap. Thank you. Thank you for this first set of questions and answers. I think it's Vanessa's turn now.
Thank you, Corinne. And thank you also to our chair for this session. My heart is beating very fast, I admit. I am having strong feelings. I will say that this is one of the last places on the earth I expected to encounter equations between blindness and dependency or blindness and tragedy. But I feel that has happened in this session, and I would like to speak against it. I hope perhaps something was lost in translation, but I think our translators are doing excellent work. And so I think this may have to do instead with a kind of conventional medical model of disability coming into our conversation. And perhaps instead of feeling troubled by this, I should try to welcome it as an opportunity for me to kind of affirm my own learning over many decades of listening to, reading, and working with people in disability studies, including experts on blindness studies, that blindness gain is a lived reality, and it is a lived reality for both blind and non-blind people. And I would suggest in the context of prisons, our crisis has to do with over-incarceration, often with the racism and classism that shapes over-incarceration, and that the problem will be the industrial prison state and not the experience of people who are within that state who happen to be blind. And so I just do not come with a question. I come with an effort to affirm my strong belief that equations between blindness and dependency, blindness and vulnerability, or blindness and tragedy call for our critical reevaluation rather than our affirmation. And so I will hope for my heart rate to slow, and I will listen and learn from others who have raised their hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Vanessa. Merci pour ces commentaires. C'était un commentaire, non, pas vraiment une question. Donc je
thank pense you for
que...
this comment rather than a question. I think we can therefore hand the floor to Susan, who did have her hand raised after Vanessa. Susan, please go ahead.
What I wanted to really, I wanted to sort of agree with Vanessa, but I also wanted to state that my heart was beating fast as well, because I found myself getting really, really quite riled. But I wanted to ask, really, you know, this blinkered, I don't want to say attitude, but it is a blinkered statement. And I just hope that we can learn from it and we can move on from it. And I found myself re-looking at Bolt and examining the oculocentrism and ocular normativism of the whole thing. And I just thought it's scary that there's still this persistent or pervasive attitude to blindness. As a blind person myself, I acknowledge that there are differences in blindness and the conditions, so forth. You can't get away from that. But to say that blindness is tragic and blindness is, I can't remember what Vanessa said now, but we need to move on, and we need to listen to the medical model. I really feel that we need to err away from it as well. So that's all I really wanted to say.
Thank you, Susan. Merci, Susan, pour ces.
Thank you, Susan, for your contribution. If I can hand over to Zina Weigand, I imagine that she would also comment on this issue before handing back to our roundtable participants, who may also to say what they've heard here. Zina, what would you like to share?
There are two things that I'd like to say something about. First, about what Mr. Daniel Defort said. I think that Mr. Defort meets or comes across actual situations that are the opposite of what we're trying to move forward with. We're trying to think positively about blindness and blind people rather than seeing them as people who could regain sight. There's an idea about blindness in certain social conditions, in certain situations, and millions of blind people around the world, I think they don't really see things the way that we see them. We're trying to define a theoretical field that should help thinking to progress, and we hope it will help us to move forward the way we consider blind people in society, the way we make room for them, and the way in which we consider them to be people who have got something to bring to us, something to have make a positive contribution. But I imagine what can be the situation of blind delinquents in prison. The situation of blind delinquents in prison, just thinking about it gives me shivers in my spine, because it's obvious that they're going to be targeted by other inmates, that they must find themselves completely lost in a hostile environment where nothing is done to help them. And at that time, in those conditions, yes, their blindness is tragic. But what I'm trying to say is that you need to look at what we're looking at. We're not talking about the same thing here. We are an intellectual elite that are debating about an issue, an ideological issue, to try to make progress with thinking. And then there are people who are confronted with terrible realities in their lives. And yes, it comes from society. It doesn't come from them. It's not their fault. But they're not given any opportunity to get out of that. So you can react to what I'm saying, to my reaction, no doubt. But yesterday, I can't really remember whether it was yesterday or the day before, where we have Indian colleagues who spoke, and at a certain time, one of them said, you know, in our country, accessibility, that's not something that anybody's interested in. And yet we have a life, our life isn't easy. And because society isn't interested in that, because society doesn't do anything to improve things, to change things, to make happiness possible, there are millions of poor blind people who still live as beggars in some countries. So that is a reality. I don't know, Gilles Das, what you think about that, because you've studied blindness in historical situations in particular. Yes, I agree with you about the fact that blindness in certain situations, in certain circumstances, can mean that lives are tragic. But even in lives that have tragic endings, because it's not the whole life that's that, it's just certain points in life. For example, a blind delinquent is their life tragic all the way through their lives? No, I didn't say that either. I didn't say that was the case. But in those circumstances, to be incarcerated in prisons as they exist today, here Vanessa is right. Prisons, it's absolutely scandalous for everybody. And to be in prison as a disabled person is though you arrive in, it's like being in prison in the hospital. My husband was blind, as you all know, and he had a leg amputated when he arrived in hospital, and he died. And in the later years of life, it happened again. He was completely dependent, and I had to fight for him to have access to the things that he needed to survive with dignity in hospital. There are conditions in which disability, because he wasn't just blind, disability in these conditions and at that time, it is dramatic. I didn't say that it's all life with a tragedy. I'm saying that it's life inspired my work, because I saw him blind and he was an incredibly creative person. And he had a lot of humour and lots of qualities that he taught me. But I would plead for complexity, even in dramatic situations in prison. Davin Dufour also mentioned the fact that certain blind inmates are dependent on other inmates. So there are social relationships, there are aspirations, disappointments, sadness. But for me, what's really at stake is to show the diversity of possible feelings and possible life experiences, that there's not a determinism that's there to say that, oh, that's a tragedy forever. I think that even in a lot of southern countries, the life experience of blind people are very, very diverse. And there are people who can spend their lives as beggars. They can also go out in the evenings to have a drink in a bar. They can have friends. I've studied cases in the Argentinian literature where blind beggars were demonstrating in a political devastation in order to be able to continue begging. Every time there is that leeway for people, blind people, to take action and to hope for something better, to have desires, to have social ties. And I think that reality is often very complex, and it isn't reduced to one particular characteristic for your entire life. Yes, of course, life is complex to your death. Life is complex for everybody. And as we move forward, we realise it's increasingly complex. But what I want to say here is that we shouldn't, just as we shouldn't say that it's always tragic for everybody and for always, etc., etc. That's not what I was trying to say. But I also believe that we shouldn't be in to thinking that's too ideological and theoretical, to ignore the reality or this facet of reality. That's what I'm saying. Yes, I agree with you. That's what I wanted to say. In addition, with respect to what Mr. Mahmoud said, I was able to work on Tosin on, I don't know whether you've studied this rabbi's work, but I think it's at least just as interesting as, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the names of people, of the writer that you were talking about. Tanjalum. I don't know whether you know what I'm talking about here.
Oui.
Yes.
Oui.
You're talking... No, I'm not. No, that's not what I'm talking about. No, I'm not talking about medieval literature. I'm talking about a contemporary writer who unfortunately has now died at a young age, a contemporary of Tara Benjoun, who was an Algerian. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce this properly. It's called Rabah. R-A-B-A-H. Alba. And this is someone who wrote, he was blind, and he wrote his work in French. And this work was written after the War of Independence, the Algerian War of Independence. And this is interesting work. That's what I wanted to say. It's an autobiography. No, it's not just autobiographical. He's a novelist. He wrote short stories too. And this made known his culture by telling stories in schools, in cultural venues. And so it's like Tosin, he writes in a different register, a more anthropological, and with a translation. And telling popular stories. And in particular, there's one work which is partially autobiographical, which is interesting to read when you're working on blindness in Arabic literature, even though it's written in French. But Tal Benjamin aussi as well. And as to Tal Sen, his memories are amazing. As you know, he wrote his thesis. He wrote two theses, one in France and before that in Egypt on Abu Alam Mahi. And these have been published. And his autobiography is called The Book of Days. And this was prefaced by André Gide. And there's another book being translated into French with a title that didn't reflect the Arabic title. It's very interesting, which is The Inner Crossing. That's the last part of his work. It's very interesting. Yes. So his wife, Suzanne, published a book which talks about his life. I can't remember the title now. Yes, I published this in French. So Tosin wrote her book in French. It was several times. She worked on it again several times, rewrote it, and then she really wanted it to be translated into Arabic so that her husband's admirers could read it. And so it's written, it was translated very quickly into Arabic. It was written around the time of the death of his husband, and it was came out in 1969 and published in Egypt in Arabic, but it was never published in French. And I found out that this book existed by reading books about Tosin. And so I went to find it, and I found it, and I asked her to work with me to have a critical edition in French, because she did it in French, but it had never been published in French. And so it was published in French in 2011 with notes, a lot of footnotes, and an end commentary to resituate a work in the historical context, sociological context of the time when it was written. And so it's called With You From France to Egypt, An Extraordinary Love by Suzanne Tosin, 1915 to 1917. They met in 1915 and Tosin died in 1973. So there you are. So Tosin was an amazing person. And what's interesting, for example, in Tosin's life is that in Egypt, he didn't learn Braille because Braille wasn't yet printed in Arabic. And so he was advised to learn Braille when he came to do his PhD in France. And so he learned that, because he'd always worked orally with his memory, he didn't really like it. And so he came back to the old tradition, and that's how he met his wife. And so I think there's a conception of dependence and independence that varies depending on the culture that we live in. I think that independence at all costs, we can do everything alone. There are cultures where no, that's not the case, where having a guide, having a reader is part of standard existence. And Taoiseach was the greatest intellectual, intellectual in the 20th century, but from a certain point of view, literate. So because there's oculocentrism, but there's also ethnocentrism. Yes, exactly. So there we are. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for all of these comments. I now need to announce the end of this roundtable because it's in CET, it's 10 p.m. And tomorrow we have another day which will be full of presentations and discussions. I'd like to thank Gildas for having chaired this session, and a big thank you to our three speakers, Daniel Dufort, Nida Mahmoud, and Ajay Roman, who wasn't able to stay with us until the end. And also thank you to the audience for the discussions. Thank you to everybody, and have a good night or the rest of your day, depending on where you are, which time band you're in. And it'll be our pleasure to see you again tomorrow. Thank you. Good night.